This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to take a look back at the L.A. punk scene with three people who helped define it. John Doe and Exene Cervenka, co-founders of the band X, and Dave Alvin, who co-founded the Blasters with his brother Phil. After leaving the Blasters in 1985, Dave joined X for a few years as their lead guitarist, replacing Billy Zoom. John Doe has a new book called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. It collects his personal essays, along with essays by Dave and Exene, Henry Rollins, who fronted Black Flag, Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's, Christine McKenna, who wrote about the punk scene for the L.A. Times, Robert Lopez, a.k.a. Elvez, who played guitar with the Zeros, and Tom DeSavia, a music publisher and former journalist and A&R man who produced the X-anthology Beyond and Back and edited the new book with John. John Doe, Exene Cervenka, and Dave Alvin also brought their instruments and performed some songs when they spoke with Terry last Monday.
John Doe, Exene Cervenka, Dave Alvin, welcome all of you to Fresh Air. So I want to ask you all what you thought was like new about punk and what drew on the past in punk. But first, John, I thought I'd ask you to read a poem about punk that you have in The Big Black Sun.
Yes. I didn't really write this as a poem, but it kind of looks like one of those list poems. Punk rock songs are not all screaming and yelling, three chords, most Ramones songs are not, 2 minutes long, stupid lyrics with no leads, fast, loud, and atonal. Punk rock songs are provocative, immediate, hook-driven, the title usually repeated many times, specific, fast, slow, and in between.
I like that. So what do you think was like new about punk, and what do you think drew on from the past?
Just the attitude was new, freedom. And what it drew from the past was the danger and a little bit scary and a door that you maybe shouldn't have opened.
And you write, you know, that X's melodies were simple, but the chord changes were often one step off of what was expected. I think, like, the melody is often a little off, too, in that respect. Like, I'm thinking, for instance, of Johnny Hit and Run Pauline. The notes just go to this weird, I don't know if it's like a minor place, but it just kind of becomes flat in unusual places.
I don't know. You know, it's nothing that we planned. It's just the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the things that was going on in music at the time is that everything was all brainy and white guys and just thinking. And it was so much intellectualization and so many notes and so many long, you know, songs and all that kind of stuff. And that was all left side of the brain. And then the right side was punk rock. And it's just saying, screw all of this. I'm going to just do something and see what happens.
So I'd like you each to describe something that you think was unique to punk, and more specifically to LA punk. Exene?
Well, it was youth-based to some extent, although it was a free-for-all for outcasts. Anybody belonged to punk that wanted to be there. Didn't matter how old you were, what you were like, persuasions. So it was similar in that way. I think the thing that probably set it apart was it had an eye more to the future than the immediate present, even though we were so present-based, like everything was happening now. We also wanted to save the world to some extent from what we saw coming, especially what I saw coming, which was the corporate takeover of culture and things like that. We wanted things to be, real, and we thought that this music was going to prevent that from happening, because people would realize, oh, wow, this is what real music sounds like. We don't need corporate music and we don't need corporate culture.
Oh, mission accomplished. No more corporate music.
Yeah, right? Hey, you know
well
what?
Well done, guys. Yeah.
Hey, you know what?
What?
We were the ones trying to stop all that and no one listened to us. So it's not our fault that people are where they are at now.
Dave, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I was attracted to the L.A. thing because of the sense of community. And, and inside of that community was, you know, various factions and cliques and this, that, and the other. But with the Blasters, we kind of floated around the cliques. But even inside, even with the cliques and sometimes the warring factions, everybody looked out for each other. You know, everyone lended a helping hand. X helped the Blasters helped Los Lobos. You know, the Germs helped X. You could go down the list. And what always amazed me was the huge variety of sounds that came out of the LA scene, where certain scenes were maybe more limited in how they approached the music. In LA, it in that period of time, you did have everything from X to the Dickies to the Screamers. There wasn't any rules, really, you know.
So I would like you to all play a song, and like an X song, for us and see how it sounds now acoustically in the studios of NPR West.
Well, we can do that. And Dave and Exene and I, after being asked to do a number of benefits and having other band members that will remain nameless, not wanting to be benefiting El Salvador and that war, Dave and Exene and I thought, let's just do a three-piece and we'll just do some fun stuff. And so we made the Knitters, which was part of the early Americana thing. So this is a kind of Knitter version of an X song, which is called In This House That I Call Home. And let's try to stay on time and see if it happens.
Punk rock, baby.
Yes,
punk
that's
rock.
Right. 1, 2, 3, 4.
A 100 lives are shoved inside. Just right to dump their mess. Obedient host and a visiting wife come out of the bedroom, straightening clothes. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home. Beautiful walls are closing in. Looking at you, you're having a nightmare. Stumble over tombstone shoes. I reach to surround you, but it's too soon. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home. Nobody knows the party rules. Gotta get in, but there's no room. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home.
Thank you. That was John Doe, Exene Cervenka, and Dave Alvin performing the X song, In This House That I Call Home. And there's a new collection of personal essays about the L.A. punk scene that's called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. And John, Exene, and Dave all wrote essays for that. John edited the book. So can you go around the table and each share a story from the late 70s or the 80s from the punk rock scene in LA that kind of typifies for you what the atmosphere was like that was so kind of exciting and or dangerous? Something that wouldn't have happened at any other time or in any other place.
Oh, God. No pressure. In 79, we became friends with this band called The Brat. And they were from East LA, and we had them play with us a couple times. And Teresa, who also contributed to the book, invited us to a party in a backyard where they were going to play. And Exene and I went there, and we were really excited because this gave us, you know, having all these young Latino kids coming in was like, this is for real. It's not just a bunch of white runaways that like our music. So we went there, and it was great, and the Brat were playing, and they had a kind of pop sound, but they were a little more strange, and it was great. And then some guy pulls out a 45 and just starts banging off rounds, like up in the air, 45 pistol, and just shooting off rounds. And everyone just like scatters a little bit and goes, oh, damn it. You know, Uncle Tito is like gone off again. And he gets hustled out and someone gives him a good talking to. And next scene, and I thought, wow, this is cool. This is punk rock. And, you know, it didn't actually seem that dangerous to me. That's the weird thing.
Dave, you got one?
There was a club called the Starwood that I loved. And the Starwood was like, it had a dance club and it had a live music club. It had a balcony, big balcony, that if you had played the club, you could get into the club and hang out in the balcony. And every musician in town, no matter who was playing, was in the balcony trying to get drunk, trying to do this, that, or the other. And to me, a lot of the LA scene took place in that balcony of the Starwood. But then to get into the Starwood, especially with the rise of hardcore punk, you had to walk a gauntlet because there was a special entrance for musicians and this, that, and the other. But to get into that thing, there was a gauntlet of skinhead kids that you had to pass through. And it was every night was like this initiation rite where, you know, where like they do in New Guinea, where there's guys in a line and they're hitting you with sticks, you know, just to get, you know, and you just want to go to the club and have a beer, right? But I loved that club, and I loved the sort of like in Kansas City back in the 30s with the Pendergrass and the Corruption created the great music scene of, you know, that gave us Count Basie and Lester Young and Charlie Parker. The Starwood was owned by a guy named Eddie Nash, who was this gangster, a gangster, drug dealer, murderer. And I'd have to go settle up with him sometimes. You know, we'd play, the Blasters would play, and then in those days I was the sort of manager, gig guy. And so I would go at the end of the night and sit at Eddie Nash's table in this little office and pick up the money from this gangster. And so it was no different than Louis Armstrong playing for Al Capone or these kind of stories. But the Starwood to me was ground zero of L.A. It was all ages. Kids could get in. They could drive from Pomona or Pacoima. They could see X. They could see Fear. They could see the Germs. They could see the Blasters. They could see the Go-Go's. They could walk the gauntlet. They could get in fights. They could dance. They could fly through the air. And so it's that wonderful little bit of art and corruption meeting, you know, and to me, that's my memory. That's my, you know, that was my focal point of that scene.
You know, I think for me, one of the greatest things was I lived down the street from the Star with John. We lived right there. We could walk there, you know, but the Whiskey A Go-Go, of course, to me was just talking about clubs and scenes. I thought about that as being Johnny Rivers and the Doors, and I just thought of it as, you know, it's a mythical place. And the thing about going to the Whiskey for me that was great was if we were allowed in and we hadn't been, like, kicked out or whatever, was walking down Sunset Boulevard to get to the Whiskey and having to walk a gauntlet again of Hell's Angels. They'd have their motorcycles parked on the street, and then they'd be leaning up against the wall, so you'd have to walk between them and their bikes. And as a 20, 21-year-old, you know, it was really exciting and scary. But Mario, who kind of ran the Whiskey, he'd always let us in. John would talk to him. He'd go, all right, go ahead in. He wouldn't charge us. We'd see Susie and the Banshees or Blondie and all these great bands and all the local bands. And one day they said that I had a tab. I had a tab, and I could just get anything I wanted. Anytime I wanted to go to the Whiskey, which was probably like four nights a week, I could go and hang out, and I could just sign my name and get anything I wanted. And pretty soon it turned into this thing where I would be sitting in a corner booth drinking martinis with all these, like, the more, like, down and out type people and stuff, just sitting there all eating cheeseburgers, and I would just sign for it every night. And everyone, you know, I was just like buying everybody cheeseburgers, drinking all these martinis, and I felt like the queen of the world at the Whiskey, in the same booths. You know, it could have been the Doors or Johnny Rivers. It was just so exciting, and I felt so grown up and so sophisticated. And then, of course, one day I got the word that there was no more tab for me.
Let's talk about the mosh pits in LA punk. And I'm curious what it was like for you to be on stage looking down on the mosh pit, and if any of you ever did the thing where you jump into the pit and people hopefully support you.
I'm going to definitely field this one.
Okay.
I'm definitely going to field this one. Yeah. The first person I ever saw jump into the audience was me. Okay.
Oh, no.
And that happened at the Mask when there were like 14 people and the stage was 4 inches tall. In other words, that started in the punk days of people commingling with each other. The band and the audience were one. We wanted to blur the lines. No one was a celebrity. I'm on stage, you're on stage. I'm in the audience, you're in the audience. We were interacting with each other physically, jumping up and down, grabbing each other, just being kids. The mosh pit is the organized version of that that came much later in the hardcore scene where men run around in circles. And I think that describes both of those scenes kind of a little bit. The hardcore scene was different. So that was a much later creation. We didn't hurt each other or have an organized version of that. We weren't We were just more like spontaneous than that. So, no. When we first started seeing that, we were like, what the heck?
When you started seeing the more violent version of the mosh pit, is that what you mean?
Well, when we started, like Dave was talking about with the gauntlet, it's like, whatever happened to just, you know, walking down the street and going into the club and having a good time? And so all of a sudden it became very, in a weird way, it was kind of like almost a political correctness thing. Like you had to behave a certain way to be allowed to be a punk rocker, and then we were like, we didn't know where they were coming from with that. So
yeah, it became this thing of, in the early days, there kind of was no rules, right? And then, I won't say what year, but it was early 80s, there became rules of, this is punk rock, this isn't punk rock. And when you would walk the gauntlet, or when you would play a gig, you know, and some 16-year-old kid decided that, no, you weren't punk rock, and you're going to get a beer thrown at you, that kind of thing. It, you know, it kind of soured me eventually on the scene, because the violence got to a point where it seemed like there were guys that were, you know, they heard about this stuff called punk rock, and you could go and you could bash into each other in front of the stage. And then it became, I'm going to go beat somebody's brains out tonight because that's what's cool. And that became kind of weird.
Well, Dave, you tell a story in Under the Big Black Sun about a bottle that was thrown at you. Would you tell that story?
Well, I had a few, you know. everybody did in those days.
Sorry to hear it, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there was one particular one. I had a 61 Fender Mustang, and I still have it, but that was the guitar that I played back then. And we were playing the Cuckoo's Nest, opening for an Orange County hardcore band called The Crowd. You know, a lot of the people in the audience liked the Blasters, and it was okay, and everything's cool, everything's great. But then there's an element of the audience that hated the Blasters. You know, we were almost like their older brothers who liked rhythm and blues, you know, and they were going to show their displeasure. And yeah, one kid threw this beer bottle really well, and he threw it right at my head. And I raised, in one of the, maybe the greatest moment of my life physically, I raised the guitar up to cover my face at exactly the time that it got to my face, but the guitar got in the way. And yeah, there's about a 6-inch long, 1/4 inch deep gash in the Mustang to this day from that beer bottle. And, you know, that kind of stuff happened. You know, I remember it was in the 90s, about in the mid 90s when I started relaxing before I went on stage, because I could go, oh, wow, nobody's going to throw anything. I think those days are in the past for me, you know?
And
yeah, it was very important to keep your eyes open.
Yes, at all times.
Very important.
Did you ever wonder, like, what is it about the music that is connecting with that kind of chaos and violence? I mean, you had obviously your own kind of energy and anarchy and defiance and anger, but it wasn't about beating people up, and it wasn't asking people to commit harmful acts against each other, and certainly not to throw bottles at you. So, like,
what happened was punk converged at the same time that Southern California suburbia was collapsing, and people were getting divorced, and their kids were doing drugs in the morning before school because mm-hmm. it was on the coffee table, and drinking. And there were all these homeless kids and all these lost kids that were getting into skateboarding and surfing and looking for a connection. And, you know, the gang thing was definitely starting up. And I think that it was just a misunderstanding with the media kind of portraying punk as violent through the Sex Pistols kind of stuff and the spitting, because the spitting didn't start in L.A. till 1980, and it ruined everything we owned, and I never got it out of my clothes. And I think it was just this weird convergence of a timeline thing with these poor kids were really, they were very angry, and I think they just misunderstood.
I agree with that, but I'd add that it's something that you can't really explain. It's like, why do people want to have sex after listening to Elvis Presley?
Well, that's pretty obvious.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Well,
why do
but
people
you can't,
have, want to have sex after listening to Lawrence Welk?
You can't.
That's unexplainable.
No, it's a feeling is what it means.
I got it. We're kidding you.
No, the music was fast, and the music was, like, chaotic, and it was, like, yeah. And so it's this primal scream, and people mm-hmm. just go berserk. And
yeah.
It took me a while to realize that when the shoe got thrown on stage, that probably the person who owned the shoe didn't throw it. It was probably his friend who ripped the shoe off of his friend and threw it on stage. It's like, there, have fun getting home, dummy.
For all the discussion of the violence, which was a part of that scene, I don't think that it was the scene.
Mm-hmm. And, I agree with that.
And so, you know, we could tell stories for hours about weird things that happened. I once saw John literally smash a guy's hand to bits on the stage of the Starwood, you know, because of this guy was making lewd gestures at Exene, and John's foot took care of the guy. You know, we all have stories, hours of stories like
Who,
that.
Me?
You, yeah. I was up in the balcony drinking a beer, trying to meet a girl, and then saw your... Anyway, but the violence that was part of the scene wasn't the scene. It wasn't what got you up every morning, because in those days there was a buzz in the air. And every night there was a different club with a great band playing. And the creativity was electric.
Can I ask you to do another X song acoustically in our studio?
Sure. Shall we try the World's a Mess, It's in My Kiss?
That's sure. A great idea.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
All things are untied. Perhaps we're boiling over inside. They've been telling lies.
Who's been telling lies?
There are no angels. There are devils in many ways.
Take it like a man. The world's a mess. It's in my kiss. World's a mess, it's in my kiss. World's a mess, it's in my kiss. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss.
Thank you. I'm so grateful to the three of you for your music and for doing our show today. Thank you so much, and all best to the three of you.
Thank you so much.
You got it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
John Doe and Exene Cervenka of the band X and Dave Alvin of the Blasters. They spoke with Terry last Monday. John Doe has a new book called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. Our next guest, comic Gerard Carmichael, is the creator and star of the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, which is now in its second season. A New York Times Magazine article described Carmichael as having, quote, one of stand-up's most unorthodox approaches to exploring race and class, unquote. In his sitcom, the characters of Gerard Carmichael, his girlfriend, his parents, and his brother typically end up in disagreements about subjects like, once you know all the allegations against Bill Cosby, is it still okay to watch his show? If your father, who abused you and your mother, dies, do you still deliver a nice eulogy? Should you see a therapist for depression? Or is depression just something that afflicts affluent white people who have the time and money to worry about such things? When Terry spoke with Carmichael, she began with a scene from the episode about Cosby. Gerard has presented his girlfriend with two tickets for them to see Bill Cosby perform his stand-up act. But she refuses to go because of the allegations of sexual abuse. He figures maybe someone else in his family will want to go, so they visit his parents' house, where they all get into a big discussion. Gerard speaks first.
For me, this whole thing isn't about guilt or innocence. It's about the fact that the Cosby Show was so important. I mean, it brought my family together. It made us realize we could go to college. I mean, we didn't, but we knew we could, and that ain't nothing.
That doesn't change the fact that he's a horrible human being. Allegedly.
Continue.
Look, Maxine, just face it. Talent is more important than morals.
What, more important? According to who?
According to you, the same woman who, despite many accusations, continues to listen to Michael Jackson.
Well, if she's listening to Michael Jackson, I can go see Bill Cosby.
Come on! give me a break. Everybody listens to Michael Jackson.
And that's my point. Everyone should listen to Michael Jackson. Even his victims should listen to his music. I mean, they probably need it more than we do. They've been through a lot.
Well, the boy's got a point. I mean, I support gay rights, but I still eat at Chick-fil-A, like a lot. Like 4 times a week. Maybe I don't support gay rights.
You're being hypocritical, Maxine. Aren't you the same person who saw Blue Jasmine during the height of the Woody Allen scandal just putting money directly into his pockets?
Fine. If you don't go see Bill Cosby, then I will never go see a Woody Allen film again.
No, I'm not judging you for seeing his movies. You should see them. He's a great artist. I'm just saying you need to separate people's personal life from their work. I mean, anybody's capable of doing something violent or disgusting, but the list of people with genuine talent is limited. So talent trumps morals.
Does this mean I could go back to listening to Chris Brown?
Gerard Carmichael, welcome to Fresh Air. So we've gotten a sense of some of the format of your show. It usually takes an issue, and then the characters who are the regulars, the Gerard Carmichael character, his girlfriend, his parents, his brother, his ex-sister-in-law, all kind of weigh in and disagree with each other and try to like resolve it in some way and keep peace in the family. So
yeah.
How did that become the premise of the show? Like, why did you want that to be your show?
It's kind of the premise of my life. So it worked. It's a very real thing. I grew up in a household that's very argumentative and, you know, a lot of times in a very healthy way. And my friends and I try my life, I like to say, is like populated like Lincoln's cabinet. You know, it's just a bunch of people that disagree with me and us on a quest for the truth. So that's kind of what we do. That's who I am and who my friends and my family are. So it just made sense for the show.
My impression from the show is that you think a lot of people have things that they don't want to admit to. They think things they don't want to admit to.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of things. It's as a comedian, it's kind of my job to mine those thoughts. And you know when you've stumbled upon a truth, a hard truth, or something that you may even feel uncomfortable saying into a microphone, and that's when you know you've got some gold.
So how many of these episodes come out of your life?
The perspective is real. More so than the situation, the perspective is very real. The perspective is a lot of times from my life and my real life perspective. I have my family on the show. They portray my family, and I'm using real names, so I try and be very mindful of their privacy and even my own privacy. And
but you're
and
using their real
stories.
Names or just your real name?
I'm using theirs too. Listen,
oh, I didn't realize that.
I did that, yeah, Joe and Cynthia Carmichael. Joe, just inviting identity theft.
I'm glad I'm not in your family.
Yeah, I know, but they're excited. They're really excited by it. I mean, because the perspective is so real, you know, the reason I use my real name for the show and even my parents to a certain extent is because it holds me accountable. It makes me really, I mean, you care because it's your show and it's your project, but it holds you accountable. A thing with your name on it, you want to protect and you want to be the best version that it could possibly be. If your welcome mat of your home had your last name on it, you would wipe some leaves off of it every now and then, I'd imagine. You kind of keep it looking decent. You don't want your name to, you know, have anything on it. So that's how I feel about the show. I want to protect it, and I want my real name, and I want my real perspective.
Am I gonna forget where I came from? Of course I am. Like almost immediately. Like I don't even like the term give back to the community because it implies the community gave me in the first place. Which they didn't. The community stole my bike. That's what the community did. The community. Like I don't know if you guys ever watch movies like Dangerous Minds, but if you did, you know there's always two types of inner city youth, you know? There's reachable, that was me, and then there's hopeless niggas. And I was reachable,
you know? Like, in the movie, his name is usually Jamal. And, like, Jamal's in a gang, but he writes poetry in secret on the weekends. That was me. I was like, Jamal. Do you know how many teachers have walked up to me at my desk and whispered in my ear, "You're not like the others." A lot. This happened a lot. Jamal always lives with his grandma. And, like, his grandma's always unreasonably ignorant toward education. Like, he misses a few days of school, and then Michelle Pfeiffer comes to his house, and she knocks on the door, and she's like, "You know, we really miss having Jamal in class." And then his grandma says some ignorant like, "Books don't put food on the table." You know, like, some stupid like that? And you're like, it's that type of environment.
That's Gerard Carmichael from his HBO special Love at the Comedy Store. So were you the kid who teachers whispered in your ear, "You're not like the others"?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot.
How did you take that? Because it's nice to be considered, you know, the smart one and all that, but it's so dismissive of everybody else.
It is. Well, first of all, I think everybody has a certain amount of potential. It just has to be woken up. And I think it's kind of this chicken or egg thing where it's like, am I different because I'm told that I'm different, or do I feel different? And then that just heightens it. That gives me license to embrace that when people tell you. So for me, you know, I express that through joke, because I really think that a lot of kids from my situation or background are different, even if they don't know it, even if they don't know their own innate potential. I wish that more people knew that.
So I should say, in that clip, some people listening to it will have been disturbed by the use of the word N-word. If you were me, would you have bleeped it?
No, everybody should be able to say it. Like, what if we, you know, I'm very much so, you know, an advocate for let's strip the power away from it. It's like, the more you hold it, if you put something in a box and label it, you know, private, everybody's going to want to peek into that box. Everyone's going to think that it harnesses a certain amount of power. And so for me, it's just like, yeah, say it. Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
Okay. So describe the neighborhood where you grew up. You grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina?
Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It's a working class neighborhood, a lot of hardworking people. I grew up around, I guess you would describe the neighborhood as a inner city. It's, you know, there's a lot of hardworking people. And then there are some people who, by means of circumstance, have to, you know, resort to certain things, you know, to make money or whatever. And it's a lot of people that are struggling. And that's what I grew up around.
So your father was a truck driver. I don't know if there were any people who you knew in your neighborhood who had gone on to, like, any kind of career in performance or show business. I think when you grow up without knowing people who can do that, it seems like a very distant dream, like a very out of reach ambition. So what made you think that you could actually do it? Because you, as far as I know, you moved to L.A. without a whole lot of experience trying to become a comic, and like you succeeded, but you must have either really been driven or, you know, had the confidence that you could do it.
Yeah, well, first of all, growing up where I grew up, a lot of things that shouldn't feel unreachable feel unreachable. I didn't know people who made it in the entertainment industry, but I also didn't know any doctors. And I also didn't know any lawyers, and I didn't know, and just these things, and not seeing that and not being around that, you don't think that it's an option. You don't know what your options are. You don't know what you can do. And I was really blessed to have people that allowed me to realize that the world is mine as well.
What was your parents' reaction when you told them you wanted to be a comic?
They'd never seen it happen before. They hadn't seen anyone make it or really knew any comedian. So it's a certain amount of caution. My mom, you know, was nervous because my announcement that I wanted to be a comic was the announcement that I was moving to Los Angeles. So that was all in one thing. So they had a double thing to deal with. They're like, all right, so you want to be a comedian in LA? Like, so you're going to go, you know, 2,000 miles away to try a thing that you've never tried before. It's a very strong amount of caution, but they were also excited, you know, also curious, I think. Why not? I didn't go to college, so it was like, why not? Let's see what happens.
Had you done any stand-up yet?
Not any stand-up. A friend of mine, Ashley, encouraged me to do stand-up. She told me, again, you're not like the others. She said, you think like a comedian. You don't think, you think in jokes and you think like in a really specific way, and you should do stand-up. And I kind of dismissed it and said, yeah, sure. And she was like, no, you really have to do stand-up. And then she refused to talk to me until I made plans to do stand-up comedy. She just said, I won't talk to you until then. It kind of pressed me to just go, why not? And then my sister bought me a one-way plane ticket to L.A., and then I told my parents I was moving, and boom.
You've had some good people in your life.
Some great people. I mean, some great moments. I was working at a shoe store, and I remember feeling kind of lost, not really sure what I wanted to do in my life. I'm still just working at at the shoe store with no direction, and a guy came in. And I'd already been kind of considering LA, and he came into the store one day, and you just kind of make the sales associate small talk and asked him what he did. And he said he was an actor. And I said, oh, really? I was like, that sounds like fun, man. I've always wanted to do that. And he said he lived in LA. And I was like, oh, man, I always wanted to go there. And he said, just move. And I was like, oh, you could do that. And he was like, yeah, go to Westside Rentals or Craigslist. I didn't have the $60 for Westside Rentals account. So I went on Craigslist and found an apartment and called my sister and said, I want to do this. And she got a plane. This all happened within like a couple of days. So I want to do it, and then made plans to move to LA kind of immediately.
Okay, so you get to LA. You have no experience doing stand-up, but it's your goal to do stand-up or to get a sitcom. Mm-hmm. Nothing in your life has given you any reason to truly believe that this could happen. So you get there, like, where do you start?
You hit open mics. I went to the Comedy Store first. And you go to the Comedy Store, the Improv, the Laugh Factory, these clubs I still do and that I still love. And you just jump in. You like, that's that what I believe in. More than anything is my ability to figure something out. So I moved to LA with the intention of figuring out stand-up comedy. And while I was excited about doing a sitcom and I was excited about acting, when I first moved, I was just doing stand-up comedy. I dedicated my life. I ignored the industry. If anything, I ran from the industry. I used to go to New York for pilot season so I could just do stand-up and just focus on that. And I didn't want to just be cast as a friend in a sitcom. I wanted to work on stand-up. I wanted to be great at stand-up. I don't see why you would do anything without the intention of being the best. So that was the goal. It was like, well, first, you know, the open mics, and then the shows that I'm on, and then whatever comes next. So I just moved with a lot of intention to figure it out.
Most comics have stories about their early days where they really bombed and it really hurt, and maybe it took another like week or month or year before they had the courage to go back on stage. Did you experience anything like that?
No. I've had moments. I've had some real moments of like just probably the worst bomb I ever had was. I'd been doing stand up for a couple of years, so it didn't shake my self esteem in any way, but it still hurt. But it wasn't like core shaking. I was in Baltimore, and a close friend of mine had just passed away, and I was rusty because it was after Christmas and I hadn't gone up in a while. And I remember getting on stage and just having the worst set ever. Just the worst set. People just talking and whatever. And I gave up control. It wasn't even that I lost it, is that I remember giving up. And that was a lesson in, you know, maintaining a certain drive and temperance, even while on stage, even when going through other emotions. If you don't incorporate it into what you're doing, then you shouldn't be doing it. So that was kind of a lesson in that. But my earlier days were fun. They are exciting. They're really excited. I was around a great group of people who were like-minded, who genuinely dedicated their lives to the craft. Genuinely. Like, genuinely. It was hard for me to be around people if they did too many quote-unquote normal things. If I were talking to a comic and he was like, oh yeah, well, I'm not going to go to this open mic, I'm going to go watch this football game, I'm like, oh, I don't think we could be friends. I don't think we have anything in common. It's like, yeah, I dedicated every fiber of my being to figuring out stand-up comedy.
So you do some really, like, I don't know what to make of that kind of comedy. Like, for example, in one of your comedy sets, you do something like, and forgive me for paraphrasing, forgive me for killing the joke. But
no, it's okay. But it's about the thought behind it now.
Okay, so you say something like, well, I'm lucky there was slavery, because you want to take it from there? Your turn.
That's the thing. Oh, we should definitely do like a go on the road, just Abbott Costello. You just say a very controversial thing and then just pass me the mic. It's like, Terry, just get something. We're lucky there was slavery. Gerard, you want to take it from me? Well, yes, Terry, I will take it from here. Without doing the joke, the thought behind it is that without slavery, I wouldn't be in America. That's a guy dealing with taking this heinous, horrible thing that is slavery and trying to find a silver lining, which is that we are in America with a lot of opportunity. And it's like, the question begs, would I trade slavery for this experience, or was slavery... And even the pain that, you know, you can use to motivate you, and the what's left over from it, do I take that and use it as fuel? And what do you do with it? It's that same question of like, well, what do I do with that? What do I do with the fact that slavery did bring us to America, and that I am embracing the freedom that America provides? So in a sense, am I thankful that slavery happened? It's weird. And it's a weird thing that a lot of people, you know, shut down. You know, you hear buzzwords and you hear certain things and people are inclined to shut down and just dismiss it as, no, that's not a thought you're supposed to have, but it's a very real thought and a really real question. And so that's where the joke came from, without saying the joke itself.
You must get, though, some surprising, interesting reactions when you do that kind of jujitsu comedy where you put out this premise that sounds like really weird, and it's not like you're endorsing it, but you're putting it out as this kind of challenging thing and turning it on its head and everything. So do people ever really take offense? Do you get booed? Like, what are some of the things that you have to deal with when you do that kind of comedy?
People, that's the challenge is earning the laugh, and the laugh is the reward for the thought. And some people, like I said earlier, like, they just shut down. Certain people shut down. And the fun thing is to try and win them back or get their attention and make them listen to what I'm actually saying. And so you sometimes have strong reactions. And I like that. I like when I'll put out a premise and the reaction is very strong, because that way I know you're listening. You're ready to hear, because it better be good. Whatever you say after this, it better be good. It better be worth this emotion that I'm expending.
That is why I handed the mic to you.
Yeah. Oh, our tour is going to be amazing.
I know.
You and I just...
So, you know, earlier we played that part of your comedy where your teachers would say to you, you're not like the others, you're special.
Yes.
Did any of your teachers get in touch with you after your sitcom went on the air?
I maintained, there was one teacher that's very important to me, very, very important to me, Corinne Van Meter. And we maintain a certain correspondence throughout, before the show was on the air, and I don't want to lose touch with her. She's so important to me and literally changed my life. I mean, in fifth grade, we did a morning news program, and she told me that I was going to produce this morning news program. And every day, first of all, we did everything from picking out my co-anchor, the theme song, the format, the writing, the joke of the day. And she said, you're going to produce this show. We'll go in on the weekends. She would come in on the weekends, and she said, you're going to produce this show. And she would give me an hour during class to go off and write the script for the next day, which she would then take home and type and, you know, reformat so we could have scripts for the next day. It's like literally changed my life. That was such an important experience. I mean, without, you know, her even showing me that that was an option, I don't know where I'd be, to be very honest with you. So that, very specifically her, I want to always keep contact with, because she's so important to me.
I love that story.
Yeah, I would write in every day. I mean, I could say it now because she took me out. She took me to see my first play. She took me go to she took me to like North Carolina School of the Arts. It's a college that was down the street from me, you know, and she took me there and on the weekends and showed me how production worked and showed me those things. So I always, you know, felt like a producer. I always felt like an actor. I always felt like a writer since that time, just knowing that it was an option. I wrote a poem once, and she called the news and got me on the news, like the local news for it.
Wow.
I mean, just genuinely a beautiful soul and an amazing teacher who changed my life. It really, really changed my life.
I'm glad you're still in touch with her.
Absolutely. You can't lose touch with her. She's such a, you know, an amazing soul.
That's wonderful.
I hope she hears this. I love her.
Well, Gerard, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Viv. This is really fun.
Gerard Carmichael speaking with Terry Gross. Carmichael co-created and stars in the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, which is now in its second season. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.